You'll get something of an American history lesson, and that may be difficult at points. I hope not too much. What I'll be doing today is doing a very broad overview of what I would take to be a kind of cultural studies approach to the analysis of politics and political systems. Then Friday, with any luck at all, I will do a much more particular application looking at the 2007-2008 presidential election. With any luck at all, meaning I can actually go on the internet and pull down some materials. So we'll see if that works. And if not, I'll just retire into my 19th century Irish Patriots lecture. But we'll see. Anyway, it is a pleasure to be back here. As was pointed out somewhere, I've been coming on and off since 1992, when I was dragged over by Finn Jokko Salonen to come and convince Kari to bring me over for a lecture when I was teaching in Uppsala. And I found I enjoyed myself more here than there, and so I have come more often here than there. And I've had quite a few opportunities to observe Finnish politics. I've taught short courses on visual politics and cultural studies several times with students pursuing projects that tap into largely Finnish political myth, the depiction of Kekkonen as an athlete in both here in the United States, and the observer of nativist cultural processes such as going to smoke saunas wrapped in animal skins, one of my very favorite. And posters depicting people's reactions to German and Russian-based governments during World War II. Tarja Halonen's display of jewelry as marks of her femininity during the 2000 election. And I was even asked once to comment on nonverbal behavior in a language I didn't know in the 1994 election with Ahtisaari and Rehn. So in my visits to Finland, I've spent much time on the visualization of politics, first in the United States and a little bit here. And I'm returning to that topic in part, but with a much broader view. I've devoted most of my political scholarship to the last 35 years trying to answer a single question. What happened to American politics when electricity came? And I'm enough of a student, I hope, of cultural politics, especially cultural history, and to be interested then in a larger picture of how these become forces that begin to change and drive the political culture in particular ways. Of particular interest to me is the sense of crisis in governing that's regularly been talked about in the United States since the 1960s, now close to 50 years. That the American sense of political unease runs deeper, though, than those issues of the 60s, the anti-war, civil rights, environmental, and women's rights conflict that erupted in that decade. The sense of political crisis experienced in the United States, I think, is directly related to the Greek root of krisis, that sense of dividing or breaking asunder, where judgments are forced choices, where there are no places for compromise. So even in spite of all the euphoria produced by the election of Barack Obama, at least in my house, the United States once again is living through a depressing governing crisis of extraordinary proportions. And it's related, I think, to multiple events. Washington, D.C.'s near meltdown when the lame duck President George Bush was confronted with unimaginable economic turmoil, an executive bureaucracy, parts of which have been under sustained attack in both the media and the courts, a polarized legislative branch, uneasy because of the agonizing issues it faces with bailouts, job bills, medical reform today, war policy, prescription drugs, surveillance of citizens, permissible civil relationships between same-sex partners, and other hot-button issues that seemingly have very serious party and personal consequences. And then a judicial apparatus that, where the process of confirming federal judges via the advice and consent of the Senate permits the country to see in glaring clarity the religious secular, the conservative liberal, the class, gendered, and race lesions in the body politic. And just ask Sonia Sotomayor. And it's particularly hard, as we saw last year, to run a business as usual election, even when difficulties in governance become the actual issues in determining elections. Now, the United States is living through a political crisis that I think has analogs throughout history, from ancient Rome, 18th century France, 19th century Sweden, 20th century Russia and China, It may be something of an overstatement to compare our crisis with those that remanufactured political cultures wholesale. Perhaps it is, and yet I hope you'll agree when I'm done that even the most amenable of the American founding fathers would argue that the United States and its politics ain't what they used to be, that its structure and even its temper has evolved to a point where we have strained and maybe even broken the compact that produced the United States Constitution. We live in a climate of confusion, consternation, and cussed conflict. So the goals of this lecture are twofold. First, to understand some of the major changes in political campaigning and governance that developed across more than two centuries of American politics. That's the history lesson. And I'll pay particularly attention to gaps and pressure points in the democratic political institutions that were laid bare over that time. And then second, I'll point to the most urgent consequences, it seems to me, problems needing attention from American legislators, judges, presidents, academics even, pundits, and all the little commentators who appear in little boxes on CNN and Fox TV, and yes, citizens who must be willing to shoulder the burdens of reform. And to pursue these goals, I'll consider four systemic changes. You'll see them on the handout clearly. In American government since the Constitution was ratified in 1787. And I'll argue that those four points of change, progressive, they seem very progressive so they seem, account for some of the most problematic aspects of American politics today. And they are, one, the increase in public participation in political activity, including street politics or the rise of serious political activity outside of the established political institutions. Two, spectacle or the increasing visual access of citizens to politicians and of politicians to citizens. Three, electrification or the opening of electronic channels of communication between leaders and the led. And four, backlash, or the rise of a cynical and outraged portion of the citizenry ready to form well-financed public and private pressure groups to battle political institutions and to work as political vigilantes in the public sphere. Okay. So then, first of all, the remaking of American political culture in the 19th and 20th centuries. And this will begin with figure one, or diagram one. The traditional institutions of national politics and governance, the United States, of course, inherited from the mother country, Great Britain, built into the mixed government form with the executive, legislative, and judicial centers of political activity, and interwoven through them a series of checks and balances, hopefully guaranteeing that no one central governing power could wholly control the other two. As initially conceived of in the United States Constitution, the citizenry was to be served by the government centers, but citizens actually participated only at times of elections, voting only for presidential electors, members of the House of Representatives, and state officials, not directly for presidents, not for senators. That's why they're outside the triangle in that first diagram. Citizens originally had almost nothing to do politically at the national level. You'll see kind of a dashed line. They could try to impeach or recall the president. That was a kind of power exercised only twice in the United States history at all. And neither actually came to a judicial resolution. But step by step, the insulated national political system underwent assault and reform, producing the four changes that reconstituted American political culture in our time. The first factor, public participation. First came new levels and kinds of public participation in politics. The new levels began with more direct and frequent contact between citizens and candidates during elections. While presidential campaigning has always been a raucous affair that amazed French observer Alexis de Tocqueville in 1831, it was not until the late 19th century that candidates themselves went on display. Before then, only surrogates campaigned for presidential candidates. But in 1896, candidate William McKinley sat on his front porch. He didn't go out. They came to him. As 750,000 delegates came by to wish him luck. And in the 1900 election, Teddy Roosevelt actually started campaigning. He hit the road, traveling some 21,000 miles in search of votes. Such reaching out to the people peaked geographically in 1960 when Richard Nixon lived out his campaign promise by visiting all 50 states, including the new states, Hawaii and Alaska, during the campaign. So by the eve of the Iowa caucus, the first of the official campaign events in 2008, candidates were swimming in frequent flyer miles. John Edwards visited Iowa 47 times, Mitt Romney 41, Barack Obama 39, Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton 34 times, Mike Huckabee 27. Familiarity breeds votes. And as we say, if an Iowan hasn't met a candidate three or four times, you're not going to get the person's vote. In talking then about popular participation in this analysis, I'm referring in part to the growing sensitivity of national political institutions to the citizenry marked last year by the sheer number of presidential primaries and caucuses in early 2008, three times as many as there were in 1900. Additionally, popular participation has become a central aspect of not only campaigning, but also governing, where citizens originally had no role, as I said, except recall. If Jeff Tulis and some of his colleagues observed, Franklin Roosevelt successfully appealed to the public and public opinion for support of proposals he knew would be resisted by Congress in the 1930s. Roosevelt's fabled fireside chats were directed not at the legislative and judicial branches of government, but at the people. He described the problems he believed the federal government should be addressing and asked the public's help. The public responded with letters to the president and to members of Congress. The public was becoming directly involved in governing. By now, President Obama not only schedules far more press conferences than his predecessor, but he uses both radio television addresses and a computer network, BarackObama.com, to reach citizen activists. And thanks to the ubiquitous public opinion poll conducted and disseminated all the more quickly by the Internet, the aggregated numbers personify the public voice. My voice is a percentage by now of the whole in terms of agreement, disagreement, or no opinion on specific issues. The Internet has put the pop in popular politics. And not only have politician-citizen interactions increased then over time, but the last 2.25 centuries have witnessed the development of a strong political consciousness in citizens acting outside their direct relationships with representatives. The profound growth of citizen action blocs and organizations over the last 200 years has made street politics at least as important as the maneuvering occurring in marble buildings. What is particularly important about the formation of public blocs and political organizations is that they formed a set of politicized structures existing outside governmental centers of power. Their force was to expand the places of the polis, which is to say the places where politicking gets done. Now school libraries and church basements, street corners and public parks have become politicized spaces. The great halls of Washington, D.C. or state capitals are not the only sites of serious political activity. Habermas taught us to call the places of citizen politics the public sphere. Furthermore, once social political movements and clubs were organized and permitted to operate, the West slowly began to understand that not only were matters of political policy at stake in politicking, but also political polity. Thank you, Kerry. Our sense of political identity. So peacenik or pro-lifer or neoliberal became labels for political actors so committed to a cause as to embody that cause in their public names. In other words, with the organization of citizens in the public sphere came important reconceptualizations of public life itself. Politics came to have as its outcomes not only policies, but public collective identities. The new political blocs and organizations of the 19th and 20th centuries created bottom-up issues and identities, experientially based politics and policies and polities. By now, many of our political groups name themselves demographically. The National Organization of Women, the Black Caucus, the National Council of La Raza, Americans United for Church and State, Friends Committee on National Legislation, Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, We the People, American Muslim Alliance, the Lesbian and Gay Political Alliance. Populism then sensitized the people to the fact that anyone, and not just elected officials, could become a political actor with the power to change the world. We all, for better or worse, became citizen politicians, a sea change in American political culture. Okay, the second force, spectacle and specularity. Martin Jay has termed all Western cultures ocular-centric, that is, societies that put their reason and faith in what can be seen. Spectacle, of course, has been part and parcel of political performance since Egyptian ideograms, the Trojan horse, Roman triumphal parades of conquered prisoners down the Appian Way, medieval mystery plays, the battlefield flags of the War of the Roses, Elizabeth I and Sun King Louis XIV's use of reflected light to suggest their charisma, and the pomp that accompanies every coronation, inauguration, and other national ceremonies of empowerment. Spectacular political performances still are central to political culture. Think back to the 2 million people President Obama's inauguration. But in our time, we have been subjected as well to a patently pictorial bombardment. That's how most of us attended the inauguration. We sat by our television sets. Now, governments were quick to use visual media to present themselves to the public. Newsreels were imported from France into the United States in 1911, and by the middle of World War I, the U.S. Department of War was making propaganda films for distribution to movie houses across the country. More famous were the Farm Security Administration's documentaries during the 1930s, presenting Roosevelt's views on soil conservation, water erosion, and the desirability of hydroelectric plants along the Great American Rivers. Frank Capra's Why We Fight series from World War II vilified Nazis and the Yellow Menace. And more affirmatively, government photographers were always on hand to snap a picture or shoot a video of presidents kissing babies, christening battleships, or laying wreaths, their governors at work popularly. And of course, with the coming of television, hour upon hour of political images flowed into the living rooms of American households from the early 1950s onward. John Kennedy stood for a record number of televised presidential press conferences. The major U.S. networks all made television documentaries and so-called white papers on issues they believed needed resolution, especially in the 60s. And government spokespersons made themselves available every day to cameras so they in time to be shown on the 6 o'clock news. Now, it is true, of course, that the great web of political action groups also could command television cameras, but what John Walsh calls the dramatization of authority almost always, is best performed by the recognizable figures of central government. In our time, President Obama, Secretary of State Clinton, Secretary of the Treasury Geithner, and, of course, those deflated punching bags, the presidential press secretaries who are on television every day. The centers of political power garner the most television time, almost without exception, not counting Wolf Blitzer on CNN. And so definitions of political problems and their solutions are often the products of what can be visualized. To Murray Edelman, citizens understand threats and reassurances by what they see on TV. His views were substantially illustrated by the succession of justifications for the Iraq invasion offered in telespectacles. Vice President Cheney held press conferences in March 2002 asserting proof of the presence of chemical and nuclear weapons. President Bush, who couldn't say nuclear, by the way, made his October 2002 speech to a handpicked Cincinnati audience of 500 screaming, applauding supporters of U.S. action. And Secretary of State Colin Powell in February 2003 offered show-and-tell pictures of the weaponry in his U.N. appearance. By March 2003, in other words, the month of the invasion, two-thirds of the American public was convinced that the country should take military action against Iraq. More recently, the constant bombardment Americans have been subjected to dealing with banks, mortgages, hedge funds, whatever they are, the stimulus package and auto industry bailouts all have been brought to us via primetime press conferences, Sunday morning network talk shows, special segments of the Jim Lehrer Show on public television or Anderson Cooper 300 on CNN, and everyone on CNBC all the time. The week before Congress passed the stimulus package in February of 2009, 72% of the population supported the president. Political show and tell once more. And if you don't see it on TV, news, and commentary, then you likely don't think it's important. But if you do, you see the threat, but at least often are reassured, not counting healthcare reform, by what you see as government responses to it. And what then of the citizenry? I would suggest that we understand our political selves and our world by how we, too, are depicted in visual media. People like us are shown throughout campaigns, cheering the political heroes and booing the villains, and people like us are interviewed on the street or in their homes, praising or blaming politicians for their situations. Visualized, mass-mediated political spectacles provide subject positioning. We are positioned in relationship to or oriented toward what we see by the images themselves. That image on a television screen is framed so that that limits our range of vision. The scene is shot from a particular point in the environment that controls our perspective on what we're seeing. And of course, the actual images have been selected and edited for our viewing, and that's all we can look at from places that aren't home. And when those images of our people are of people like us, we're very likely to let those people stand in for us. Specularity, then, is a matter of having our objective knowledge and subjective experience of the world guided or even controlled by the sight, sound, and words of what politicians in the network show us about the world and about ourselves. Now, some may want to argue that control over a citizenry's information and opinions is no different in the age of television and film than it was in the heyday of newspapers. And I agree there's some truth to that assertion, though if we again go back to Martin Jay's characterization of ocular centrism, of the centrality of what we see to what we know, then the visual has a special place in the subjective and intersubjective experience and is not so vulnerable to the limitations of literacy and rationality that printed language is. Newspapers are dying, even as the consumption of visual media occupies increasing amounts of time. Spectacle has remade relationships between political institutions and citizens. Electrification. The third change affecting American political culture, determinatively then, is electrification. It must be separated from the specular or visualizing mass media, of course, because not all electrified media use visual channels of communication. It is true, however, that when we talk about electrification in politics, we usually think about the electronic media for mass dissemination of messages, film, radio, television, computers. And as I was suggesting when talking about telespectacles, mass-mediated political images seemingly work most powerfully in the West when positioning citizens in particular relationships to politics, to public policies, and even to each other. And I say each other in recognition of an argument that runs from Walter Lippmann's analysis of media power in the 1920s to Hanno Hart's most recent 2004 pronouncement that the disseminating mass media create our sense of publicness, of who we are collectively, of what Benedict Anderson called imagined communities. Electrified telespectacles build such communities. But yet we should not consider only the broadcast media as sources of political culture and participation in our communities. Telephones tie people together and hence help in the formation of political blocks, all the more so in our time of robocalling and short message systems or SMSs. The fax machine got messages out of the Republic of China during the 1989 resistance centered in Tiananmen Square, and mass protests from the 1999 World Trade Organization's debacle in Seattle to the estimated 10 million people assembled in world capitals on February 15, 2003 to protest anticipated U.S. invasion of Iraq were all ingathered via internet-based and satellite-based networks. Good old-fashioned email and listservs, as well as those creatures of the late 90s, blogs, and cell phone messaging systems. On a smaller scale, consider the crowds at some of the Obama campaign rallies, 23,000 in Des Moines, Iowa, of all places, 50,000 in Manassas, Virginia, 80,000 in Portland, Oregon, 80 to 90,000 in Columbia, South Carolina, 100,000 in St. Louis, Missouri, 200,000 in Tiergarten in Berlin. Digitalization, allowing web-like connections between ideas and people through simple computer searches, message forwarding capabilities, and short message cell phone software, has helped create whole new political blocks forming without regard to the traditional limitations of time and space. You don't even need bodily presence to participate. You could have attended those Obama rallies on YouTube or Twittered with the people standing there. The new electrical sublime, Leo Marx's phrase for our love of electrified life, demands that we pay very close attention now to internet-based politics, or politics called also 2.0. In 2007-08, we witnessed the attractiveness of Facebook and Twitter in drawing supporters to candidates' websites. More than that, we saw that the World Wide Web was used not only for signing up voters and increasing political contributions to obscene levels, but it turned at-home nerds, sleuths, and bloggers into significant purveyors of political information, opinion, and advice. We witnessed world-changing citizen activities during the last election, the eruption of open-source politics. In an open-source system, everyone's potentially a political informant, opinion leader, and recruiter. If Hillary Clinton makes an ad, 600 other people can respond to it on the net and attack her message, as happened when she made the so-called 3 a.m. ad, who's going to answer the phone, in February 2008. Or a girl named Amber Lee Edinger can call herself Obama Girl, make half a dozen music videos, and get watched 27 million times. When Obama announced for the presidency in February 2008, he already had over 500 groups supporting him on Facebook. By October, the largest, called 1 Million Strong for Barack, actually had 1 million subscribers. The Drudge Report is the sixth most popular news source on the web, beating out even the big three networks, Fox News and the New York Times. 80% of the population goes online regularly, and a significant portion of those people do more than just look at political stuff. We just have lived through an electrically powered election dividing the politics of yesterday from the politics of tomorrow. Electrification has moved the citizenry from the periphery squarely into the middle of American political culture, and that's where they are on figure two. If everything works, I'll do much more with that on Friday. Backlash. And finally, the fourth force. In the reconstitution of American political culture, I come to the most ephemeral of the factors, backlash. The idea of backlash certainly is simple enough. At times, citizens become so fed up, disillusioned, or frustrated with the lack of government activity, or worse, when government actually does something, that they rise up, putting their bodies on the line, materializing their beliefs and attitudes through physical presence or absence. A protest march or sit-in is a kind of statement through physical presence, while a strike or boycott is a message created by physical absence. And American history is filled with examples of political backlash behavior. From Shays' Rebellion in 1786, when New England farmers and laborers protested high taxes, to the fully coordinated 2003 pre-Iraq invasion marches around the world, and through all of these, people have expressed their political arguments with their feet. Backlashes, then, are efforts by groups of citizens to ask the ship of state to correct its course, to sail in fairer climes and more productive waters. They become instruments of petition, even demand for political voice and agency. In our time, backlash movements have articulated their demands in shrill and often physically forceful ways. Protests at abortion clinics stop patrons from entering. Members of both the Animal Liberation Front and the Environmental Liberation Front, ELF, break into laboratories, chain themselves to factory gates, trash property, and even commit suicide. Right now, conservatives opposed to Democratic plans for health care are shouting down advocates at public information meetings. Backlash movements in current U.S. politics are associated especially with the inflamed moral issues that drive politicians nuts. Abortion, the death penalty, gun control, animal rights, gay marriage, social services for undocumented workers. Backlash occurs where there seems no middle ground. And particularly then, morally tinged topics painted in Christian hues provided the United States with its most virulent backlash politics. Thomas Frank's 2004 bestseller, What's the Matter with Kansas, documents the political remanufacture of a liberal populist state into one of the bastions of Midwestern religious right conservatism. Their Washington, D.C. champion, Senator Sam Brownback from Kansas, gave their cause broad national exposure when he ran for the Republican presidential nomination. Morris Fiorino insists that such groups really do not swing elections, so there's little doubt that conservative backlashers have had the means to reach into the inner circles of the Washington executive offices, affecting abortion policy, stem cell research, and probably gays in the military. And I'm thinking here of the recent controversies over the military discharge of gay translators in Iraq. Now, whether the Christian right backlash played a determinative role in Bush's foreign and domestic policies, we don't know. It's moot, in a sense. What is significant is that publicly visible active backlash movements organizing at street level and creating televised and digitized images of angry citizen protests, most of it on moral rather than strictly political grounds, have come to agitate the world inside the Washington Beltway, that tidy world of elitist, balanced government that Jefferson and the other rationalists drew up. We've come a long way since quills, inkwells, and parchment recorded the American state. So, moving on to figure three, the four forces remaking the Founding Fathers' governmental system are here. With what consequences? How has increased public participation in the politics of the street, ever-increasing emphasis on political show and spectacle, two-way electronic means of government-citizen interactions, and ever-new channels for directly challenging government officials and their offices affected the day-to-day operations of American political culture? E Pluribus Unum is a statement of the endemic problem of how a young nation state without deep structuring traditions can keep from over society. This is on our money, in case you don't know. E Pluribus Unum, that phrase. Out of many, one. And how can we keep from overemphasizing manyness, which leads to fragmentation, or the other way, oneness, which leads to repression? The history of the United States political culture is always a history of how to balance and rebalance and assert and renegotiate relationships between a unitary government and a diversified population, between central mechanisms of both justice and freedom, between federalist centrality and states' rights diffusion of power, between the one and the many. We struggle with E Pluribus Unum. And for goodness sakes, we wrote a constitution in 1787 and only 4 years later passed a Bill of Rights that amended the document 10 times, and as recently as 1992 amended it a 27th time. So consequence number one, if there's been a single overarching consequence of the four mechanisms of change, it has been the rapid and perhaps too rapid democratization of the machinery of governments. The 1787 Constitution built a nice tight triumvirate of executive, legislative, and judicial power centers beholding to each other, much less so to a citizenry it served. As was characteristic of all European governments in the 18th century, Americans were expected to watch, yes, but to stay out of the way. The Bill of Rights asserted individual rights, but collectively, as a lump and mass, Americans had little to do except vote and grumble. The cry, then, for popular participation in street politics represents an awakening of citizen political privilege. With the emergence of populism, the United States was buffeted with forces that started turning a Republican or federal government into a pluralistic democratic one. The disseminating mass media brought government into the towns and homes of the entire country, bestirring political consciousness. And while film and television gave government actual visual presence, those media didn't automatically empower government action. Fictional films of the 1920s and 30s often depicted heartless, power-hungry scions of industry controlling the state, and television broadcasts in the 1950s, and I'm thinking of the Army McCarthy hearings or the 1960 CBS documentary Harvest of Shame about the treatment of migrant Mexican workers, depicted government officials exercising personal power and victimizing those they should have been serving. Populism, street politics, and spectacles powered by new technologies together produced a heightened democratic consciousness that soon expressed itself in cries for citizen entitlements and anger when those cries were ignored. The most extreme form of democracy and citizen empowerment proposed in my lifetime was Ross Perot's 1992 suggestion that the United States hold electronic town meetings with interactive television voting on issues that were discussed. And actually, we might be getting close to that political reality thanks to technologies that count internet hits and mentions. So if democratization, or Perot's heightened hyper-democratization, was one consequence of the revolutions, the emergence of a public voice is a second. Now, speechifying at election time has been a hallmark of American politics, a part of what Alexis de Tocqueville found so interesting and even quaint about American political activity, all the local public hubbub at election time. Now, if those voices were called, as a 1792 newspaper editor called them, the voices of grog because of all of the alcohol consumed at election rallies, yet an act of sinistry has always been sought out in U.S. towns and country politics. But the 20th century electronic media opened up new forms of journalism with new venues for voices to be heard outside of electing time. Radio and television turned not only advocacy groups, but also journalists, into intermediaries between governors and audiences, delivering government voices and images to the citizenry, but also the actual voices and bodies of citizens to the government officials, all managed by the professional communicators we call journalists. The place where citizen voices were amplified and given national presence then was the public sphere, which became in many ways co-equal or even superior in power to the government institutions themselves. And then the internet only amplified the citizen voices. Citizens now can gather together virtually without regard to time or place, me in the morning, my students in the middle of the night, to share information, opinion, and of course, action. Blogs are so popular that print and electronic news operatives build their own. If you know the story of the Abu Ghraib prison photos, you know a story that circulated on the web well before it was picked up by CBS's 60 Minutes 2 and Seymour Hersh of The New Yorker. Citizen voices now are loud, holding conversations in the public sphere that are heard by journalists and overheard by politicians. Expanded political dialogue, a veritable cacophony now, especially in the healthcare debate, between people and the state is fostered by new media. Public voices are now central to governing this country. And a third consequence is promotional politics. The executive and legislative branches talk to each other through electronic media in the presence of citizens. We have inserted the people, yes, diagram three, inside the executive, legislative, judicial triangle, and they have become both the conduits of talk, moving messages around within the triangle, as well as prizes that can be used by each branch to leverage power for the other branches. Public opinion, who tells you who's got power or who's got the initiative in Washington. The mass mediated political conversations of our time flow like sales and barter dialogues. Obama was busy in January and February 2009 using press conferences and town visits to sell parts of his stimulus package to the people and through them to Congress. He's been selling positive images of himself as well, knowing that a public-supported president can create fear and compliance in Congress. Along with Bill Clinton and Ronald Reagan, Barack Obama is one of the greatest promotional presidents of our time. He has the speech skills in his own website, barackobama.com, with a listserv of 13 million citizens who can respond. In our time, if you can't sell it publicly, it won't get done. And yet in a fourth place, the phrase "it won't get done" suggests one final consequence of the systemic changes I've been examining, gridlock. Gridlock is an electronics term that made its way into the heart of American politics at both the national and state levels. Legislators listened to the special interests who made contributions to their election campaigns. Presidents and governors who threatened them with dire consequences if they violate executive expectations. Party bosses and financiers. Journalists who publish daily opinion polls. And citizens who bombard them with marching orders via telephone, mail, and email. Those legislators may well campaign by taking strong stands on tax cuts or new spending or abortion reform, but once they're in the House and Senate chambers, often facing a president or governor from the other party, as well as publics who are told about their every move, they become extremely cautious. They spend amazing amounts of time blaming the other party or office for inactivity. The enduring British commitment to the loyal opposition simply has no place in U.S. politics. Democrats plead for government intervention on behalf of needy citizens, while Republicans celebrate citizens' hope for smaller and cheaper government. Five persons in the little boxes on CNN's screen endorse the Democratic proposals, while the other five express reticence or dismay. The online Huffington Report celebrates government's recognition of citizen rights, even as Patrick Buchanan's townhall.com rips into tax and spend Democrats. The parties reaffirm themselves and hope for re-election. And so only three Republican senators and no House Republicans voted for the February stimulus bill. That's gridlock. And so here we are, The traditional institutionally constituted government, this is diagram four, system of the United States has been buffeted by winds of change, an engaged citizenry now 231 million strong, issue and ideologically based citizen blocks with money, technological means for governors and their constituencies to see, envision, and engage each other, and near constant confrontative expressions of citizen demand and anger. And what consequences? Hyper-democratization, making every person his or own activist, a mishmash of voices requiring politicians to listen and write legislation while kowtowing to well-financed corporate, special interest, and citizen groups, public relations, politics, and paradoxically, legislative delay and even inaction in most sessions. So presently, American democratic institutions regularly beat up on each other in front of a bewildered and perplexed, even if political savvy, citizenry. Politicians generate very little trust, even less, for goodness sakes, than lawyers. Americans by now are aswim in contradictory streams of political information, bombarded as they are by newspapers, magazines, screaming radio and television, talk show hosts, and coiffured news anchors, special interest newsletters, and innumerable internet-based alarmists and pundits. But also, in spite of all that information, they have far, far too little political knowledge. Most of us don't know what to do, period. Actually, we know something that needs to be addressed. One of the great difficulties is that we have reconstituted American democracy in a land of plenty. We're not just a democracy, we're a capitalist democracy with an unholy amount of money available for influencing government actions. The cost of holding U.S. elections in presidential years runs not into just millions of dollars, but billions of dollars. $5.3 billion was spent in the 2007-2008 elections, $1.6 billion for the presidential contest alone. And that figure is up 27% from 2004, in spite of our Campaign Reform Act of 2002. That simply redistributed some of the campaign spending, and because it still allows presidential candidates who don't take federal money to avoid spending limits, Barack Obama took none, it provided no control whatsoever on the big spenders, and Barack Obama was the leading spender. It has been suggested that we could solve our problems by campaign finance reform, or by shortening the campaign period, or maybe even getting rid of the electoral college system in favor of direct popular elections. Well, we cannot solve the money problem until the United States quits equating the buying of ads and television time with free speech. Money talks literally in the United States. You can't stop them from buying because then you're curtailing free speech, the First Amendment. And we cannot shorten the campaign season unless states are willing to group themselves in primaries and caucuses. Much resistance from the smaller states, and we'd have to go from privately financed elections to either publicly financed elections or campaigns that could only be waged on contributed radio and television time, as in other countries. But of course, with the internet now weighing significantly in the process, control of broadcast media advertising may not be an optimal solution anymore at all. As for direct popular elections, presidential campaigns almost inevitably then would become focused on the most populous states, California, New York, Texas, the great Rust Belt states from Pennsylvania through Ohio and Michigan into Illinois. The small states, Iowa, as they did when the Electoral College was invented, would complain loudly and I think determinatively. We're a long way from direct public voting in elections. So if effective reform of the electoral system is next to impossible, is there any hope on the visual horizon? Maybe a reign of political virtue, the kind Obama kept talking about at those large rallies and in his inaugural address? Well, reigns of virtue, of course, can become notoriously repressive, just ask the French. No. If not a reign of virtue, then what? Our only hope may well be, a phrase mentioned yesterday, an engaged citizenry. For an engaged citizenry, for participatory democracy to become the way we live our life in political culture, for politicians to spend at least as much time governing as they do campaigning, political respect, personal responsibility, and a reverence for collective well-being must prevail. We need many more projects of the kind run, for example, by the University of Texas through its Institute for Civic Participation. This institute is leading the way on projects aimed at creating and educating young voters. Those projects go hand in hand with Internet and politics courses offered in the university's Department of Radio, TV, Film, and the political and campaign political courses they offer elsewhere. Research, education, and advocacy. Texas and other universities have work to do in helping to make American politics productive of life, liberty, and the pursuit of everyone's happiness. Good government projects, as they're called, can play, maybe, significant roles in public life. As is almost always the case, the demands and the consent of the governed, not of the political action committees, not of the fat cats with big bucks, not of the spellbinding ideologues of right or left, but of the governed themselves must be foundational to reform. Only if their needs and their consent are channeled into large-scale reform will the reconstitution of American political culture be truly progressive. Large-scale reform in a country as big as the U.S. cannot begin at the top. It must be at the point of oneness, no matter how loud President Obama talks it, but at the bottom, with the many, person by person, school by school, community by community, state by state, URL by URL, localist politics, as we talked about it a bit yesterday. Now, that's a lot to ask of 168 million registered voters in a country assembled, as it says in the Statue of Liberty, out of your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. That's how we talked about you when you came. But clearly, the tired, poor, huddled, wretched, tempest-tossed citizens of the United States ultimately have to save themselves. We must start saying the same thing to ourselves that we've been telling Iraq since 2003. Only citizen commitment to political participation, oversight, demands for reform, and civic duty makes democracy work. Amen.